From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Henry Rollins makes art out of rage.
I'm driven by a lot of, like, really kind of ugly anger. And so I have a lot of that in me, and it comes from a father who was terrifying and teachers who yelled at me, told me I'd never be anything. And so I descend from the sky and land on things really hard.
Ahead this hour, we talk about writing and comedy with the former frontman for the punk band Black Flag. And we'll also examine the value of a Bitcoin.
You know, Jerry, I'm not going to tell you that these will increase in value or even hold their current value. The truth is, you bought them because you like them. They have value to you. That's what matters.
Not sure that's true. New ATMs in Atlanta are equipped to spit out cryptocurrency. We'll break down what Bitcoins are and whether they're worth the investment. First, though, last week we revisited our best music segments of 2017. One of those conversations included Amy Ray of the Indigo Girls.
I love good songwriting and I love storytelling. And I have to admit, you know, I moved up to Dahlonega about 25 years ago, and being around all those players up there, it definitely got into my blood.
We asked who your favorite Georgia musicians are, and here are your first thoughts. This is Jason Hoke in Ellaville, Georgia.
I want to nominate Brent Cobb for one of my favorite musicians from the state of Georgia. Two of my favorite songs by Brent is South of Atlanta and Shine On Rainy Day. His songs really represent the Peach State.
We love getting your thoughts and suggestions. You can call us just like Jason did at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. More new and expectant mothers die in the U.S. than in any other developed nation. According to the CDC, at least 700 mothers die every year here, and Black women are at the highest risk. A recent investigation by ProPublica and NPR examines racial disparities in maternal deaths. NPR's special correspondent, Renee Montaigne, joins me from Culver City, California, where it is quite early. Good morning, Renee.
Good morning.
So there's two issues here. The first is the question of why the U.S. has such a problem with maternal deaths. And when we say maternal deaths, we're talking about both while a woman is pregnant, during childbirth, and shortly after birth, correct?
Yes. In fact, it's always important to understand we call it, generally speaking, you call it due to childbirth or in childbirth. But the CDC, Centers for Disease, CDC Prevention.
It's early. Disease Control and Prevention.
Control and Prevention. I haven't had to say it out for a long time. The CDC there in Atlanta measures for a full year from birth to full year out. It allows for the fact that the mother may have died as a result of that childbirth. So the truth of the matter is, though, most deaths due to childbirth happen after birth. A majority. Many of them in the first week, most of them in the first 6 or 7 weeks, but some of them as far as a year out.
So let's actually hear a clip. One of the people that you spoke to during this investigation was the mother of Wanda of Shalon Irving of Sandy Springs, Georgia, here in our own state. She died from complications of childbirth. And of course, her death came after the birth.
It was a great birth. It was just a beautiful time. So the problem didn't come in until after the birth, and she didn't have an afterbirth plan.
How common is it for new mothers to not have what's called an afterbirth plan?
You know, it is very common. In fact, it would be uncommon for a mother to have an afterbirth plan that would be about her own health. There are lots of afterbirth plans. Women and their husbands, their partners spend all kinds of time planning for, you know, the crib, the room, the baby's health, the party. I mean, there's lots of plans that are in place for afterbirth. But it is very unusual for people to look at the afterbirth period as a sort of a medical period. Or a period where there is any possibility of complications as long as the birth itself went well. You know, obviously a very complicated birth might, you know, result in a flow of problems afterwards that would be handled maybe even in the hospital. But the notion of postpartum care is very minimal in this country, we discovered. And I personally, I'm fixated on it, actually, because I see, because so many of these deaths occur during that period of time, it's sort of quite an amazing gap in the culture of American health and also in the system itself. I mean, I'll tell you something really quickly. I'm going to tell you about, I collected a bunch of postpartum instructions for a future story, a story that I'm working on right now. And, you know, there's like a two-page, it looks like a mimeograph from the 1950s, but it's just basically printed up postpartum instructions, what to do, come back in 6 weeks, what not to do, don't have sexual intercourse for 6 weeks, do this, do that, no, when to call your doctor, and then a list that no mother would read probably after she's brought her baby home, even more so would probably not read if, you know, she was sleep deprived, as most mothers are, if she was a little overwhelmed, if she was slightly depressed. I mean, there's no outreach for mothers after birth to speak of. It's almost like they systematically go from a healthcare system, that is the obstetricians and the constant and regular monitoring, to the birth in a hospital or maybe at home with midwives, something like that. But I mean, you know, to the birth. And then after that, they're in a whole other system. That's the pediatric system.
So let me give a few of the statistics that come from your report, the NPR's reporting and ProPublica's. 50,000 women a year experience serious complications or lose their lives during this period of time around birth. And serious complications more than doubled between 1993 and 2014, which means these kind of complications and deaths are on the rise in the U.S. while they're falling through the rest of the developed world. And Shalon's story, Shalon Irving of Georgia, actually brings us to the second part of this, which is, yes, maternal deaths are worse in the U.S. than other developed nations, but they're particularly bad for African-American women. Here is, again, Wanda, who is Shalon's mother.
There's a picture of her and Soleil with the same outfits that was taken the day she collapsed, the morning of the day she collapsed. Soleil is French for sun. She just lights up a room when she smiles. And she's the only reason I have for getting out of bed every morning.
It's so hard to listen to because, in fact, you know, that picture was indeed a picture of her and in their little outfits. And Shonda had not been doing so great after birth. She had mastered the whole pregnancy very well and shot right through it, even though she had a blood clotting disease that was under control. She had a history of hypertension, but that was under control even without drugs. She was overweight. But there were lots of things going on with her that probably in theory could have fed into what turned out to be an afterbirth. There were afterbirth issues that she could not survive. The thing that we're trying to bring out with her was if she couldn't make it, and she's a black woman, and black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in childbirth than white women. It's an astonishing, horrifying statistic. If she couldn't survive, what occurred afterwards, she died of hypertension, according to an autopsy. But there are those who would argue that what led to that hypertension was a lifetime of sort of blows. And I think I'll just throw that out. A lifetime of blows, something called a life course of, to be flat out about it, racism.
So the reason you're saying this is because Shalon was an epidemiologist at the CDC. She had 2 master's degrees. She had a PhD. She had very good health insurance. And for a long time, people have thought the disparities of race in healthcare were because of income or lack of education or lack of access to health insurance. And what this investigation finds is that's not in at all. And that just leaves us with growing up African-American in the United States.
Well, let me say this. It is it quite a bit. You know, all these sociological issues of not having the best hospitals, entrenched or historic racism, putting people in situations where they don't have jobs or generations of lack of health care, a lifetime of a lack of health care. Much of that is actually correct, and that's what Wanda, I mean, excuse me, that's Shalon. What Shalon was was studying, which is the horrible irony of all of this. She was studying it. She knew it better than anybody else. And yet she, too, died. None of that applied to her, per se. She had a wonderful team. She loved her gynecologist. I can't say every, you know, looking back, one can reanalyze everything that happened. And there's at least one expert we talked to who said she should have been put back in the hospital. But the reality is pretty much what happened to her would have happened to a white woman, as we are finding out, in her situation. That is to say, she got a certain amount of attention, but not enough. And in the end, you know, she wasn't, attention wasn't paid to what was wrong with her. But why she couldn't survive that comes down to certain things, and one of that had to do with something called aging, that is being studied and suggesting that, and the suggestion that a lifetime of stress can age your body in a way that a black woman pregnant at 35 would correlate to a white woman pregnant in her 40s. And right there, you have a real problem.
And so let's hear from Michael Liu, who was the head of the Maternal and Child Health Bureau for quite a period of time. And here he is talking about just what you mentioned.
It's the experience of having to work harder than anybody else just to get equal pay and equal respect. It's being followed around when you're shopping at a night store, or being stopped by the police when you're driving in a nice neighborhood. Those types of experiences create a kind of chronic stress that continues to gun the engine, which over time creates the wear and tear on your bodies.
But how does one, as a medical professional, how does one address that? You can't address institutional racism as a doctor.
Exactly. I mean, there's the conundrum. One suggestion, but it is that just knowledge on the part of both providers and also women themselves, and that's not unimportant. One of the things that Shalon wanted to do was be seen, be brought to the hospital. And by the way, Dr. Liu was speaking of professional black women in that. He could have been speaking of all black women, but he was speaking specifically of professional black women, saying their problems are not that different in their day-to-day life as you know, poorer, less privileged black women. And you know, one of the, you know, one thing we can offer is just information, knowledge. Know this. Know that if you, you know, there's scientific studies that study it at the chromosomal level. There are telomeres that show that they're short, that are shorter in black women in middle age than they're shorter, meaning they're aging. And so that know that the body may not be quite as adept and need more attention sooner. And if I know we had in our stories, black women are often, if we had so many different conversations and also spoke with experts, black women are often the last thing they want to do is push.
Yeah,
that would be true of most women after the given birth. They often say things like, make a fool out of myself or seem to be needy. And the point we're saying is know your body, believe what it's telling you, and demand to get what you need. And we've had at least one woman write us and say she did just that.
And
she think it saved her life.
NPR correspondent Renee Montaigne, she's been working on this investigation with ProPublica on maternal deaths and the high rate within the black community especially. You can check out all of the reporting on this series at gpbnews.org. Renee, thank you.
Oh, Celeste, thanks very much.
Just ahead, a conversation with Henry Rollins. First, though, understanding Bitcoin. This is On Second Thought. Today, a man who wears many, 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 many hats.
Salam alaikum, fanatics. It is now time to hitch up your thongs and fire up your bongs. And tonight we got some songs that will definitely make you want to break out, put your underwear on top of your head, and cause a riot.
Musician, actor, radio host, among many other things, Henry Rollins, speaking on KCRW in Santa Monica. Many know him best as frontman for the quintessential 80s punk band Black Flag. But since that group disbanded years ago, Rollins founded his own record label, created his own show on KCRW, tours as a spoken word artist, among many other things. Henry Rollins is now on tour again, and he'll be in Atlanta this week and joins me from his home in L.A. Hi there.
Oh, hello.
So this is a travel slideshow, I guess, concert? Is it a performance? What do you call it?
Oh, well, when I'm on stage just on my own, a lot of the stories I tell are informed by the travel that I do. And I take a lot of photos. And so a few years ago, at the National Geographic Theater in Washington, they asked me if I would basically do a narrated slideshow. So it's photos I've taken pretty much from every continent. And so there's a story with every photo, and that's basically the show. A dark room, a nice screen with high-resolution photographs with me in the dark talking about them.
What kind of camera do you use?
I use Canon bodies just because they're easy for me to understand, and you can't break them.
Do you drop cameras sometimes?
No, but when you travel hard, like pretty much any travel you do in Africa ages everything. Like you'll take a new pair of boots to a month in Africa and you come back and the boots look like you've worn them for 20 years. Everything just gets road hard in Africa. And when you just travel with a backpack for weeks at a time, things get knocked around. And as careful as you want to be with gear, you can't be careful enough with a lens or anything. So I just try and get like what I found to be indestructible. And I'm not trying to do an ad for Canon. It's just gear that has never failed me.
So I want to play this clip of you. You do all kinds of different shows. This is a piece of a Comedy Central feature that you did. And you're talking about a journey you took with a former colleague from Black Flag.
And we make a left into some huge supermarket, and we go right to the meat section. And he grabs a steak in its cellophane and styrofoam, tears it open, rips the meat in half, just hands me half of it. And he plunges part of it into his mouth, and he's eating it. I'm like, and I start eating it too. The entire supermarket is just silent, looking at these two men.
So I wonder, is there something particular about travel that makes it for good stories, or can you just make a story out of anything that happens in your life?
Well, for me plus travel pretty much always equals something interesting. It just depends on how you travel. I think geographic displacement, like to get you out of your normal, like right now I'm in my office.
Yeah.
I know everything in this room. It's appallingly familiar to me. And it doesn't quite inspire. And that's why when I'm off the road, I'm just usually editing. I'm just taking materials from the road, writing photos, whatever, and preparing them for, something. Or I'm getting ready to leave on a tour or something. So when I'm off the road, I'm basically preparing for the next, voyage. And my life, for me, it happens out in the world. When I'm home, I'm kind of on pause. I'm in preparation mode, which is fine, but I'd much rather be out in it. And I think that's where all the real stories are, and that's where all the life is as I see it. And that's why I always bring a camera, and I'm always writing things down, because I'm always looking for a story to tell somebody.
So one of the things that you do while you're home is your radio show at KCRW. I want to play a clip of one of the interviews that you've done. This is an interview you did with Ozzy Osbourne for the Henley Rollins Show.
Like back in the day when Sabbath was, making, the early records, I'm sure you guys got some of the most incredible bad reviews known to man.
We never, ever got a good review.
Right.
And you know what? If we did, we didn't like it. Because we were a people's band. We didn't think some executives should say we're...
Well, you got bad reviews, but every tour sold out because you were a people's band.
So what is it that keeps you going back to the radio show?
Oh, I wear a lot of different hats, I guess. So I just say yes to everything. I've wanted to have a radio show since I was about, 12 or 13. Because I was one of those shy, introspective types who, cries when the ball is thrown at his head. And so being alone in my room with my records and the radio was kind of my little universe. And I loved hearing the person talk to me between songs. And I liked the songs, this was, you know, 70s AM or FM radio, so it was really, really good music. But I liked hearing what the guy was saying or what the gal was saying between songs. I wanted to be that person. And after seeing that scene with Wolfman Jack in American Graffiti and hearing his voice, he was syndicated for a little while, and I would listen to him in Washington, D.C., where I lived. And I was fascinated by this. You can't see this person. It's all about the voice. And you just kind of wondered what they were really like. Like the Dreyfuss does in American Graffiti. And I wanted to be that person. And so many years ago in the early 2000s, I was offered a slot at Indy 103, a station that went away.
Yeah.
And after it went away in 2009, I guess it was, Jason Bentley, my boss, one of them, called me and said, "Hey, I heard about Indy 103. I'm like, "Yeah, pile on." He went, no, we're sorry about that, but we'd love to have you over at KCRW. And I said yes to that so fast, I think I sprained my jaw. Because it's such a great job. And so I've been there. I'm closing in on about 500 shows I've done at KCRW. April of 2018, I think, will be 9 years there. And I'm always relieved when they don't fire me. I have a fear of it. And I love my job there, and I really like turning people on to music. It's like the funnest of all the things I do. It's the lowest pressure. Like, I just came back from a trip where the first thing I did was a keynote speech, and then I flew to a location, and the next day was in a pilot for a TV show, and then I flew immediately from that to Luxembourg to be in a movie for almost a month, and I just returned a couple of days ago. And so that's a lot of juggling of chainsaws, and a lot of, you know, check your stomach so you don't, you know, lose your lunch on your way to work. But the radio show doesn't have any of that trepidation for me. And so having a lower stress gig now and then, because everything else I do is, you know, hey, don't screw this up. Okay. The radio show, I don't know, I just really enjoy when I get that letter from someone like, "I never thought would like jazz music, but you turned me on to John Coltrane, and now he's like my favorite musician." There you go. Or I get a letter from a band like, "Hey, we're getting all these people at our shows every night on this tour saying they heard us on your show. Thank you for playing our record." That's why I have a radio show.
So let me play a little bit, just so everyone can remember how most people first heard the name of Henry Rollins. Let me play a little bit of early Black Flag. This is Rise Above.
Rise, stop what we do. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. When they can't do it themselves. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Way up high, up your abuse. Try to stop us, it's no use.
I think some people may be surprised to hear you describe yourself as a young, shy, sort of introspective person, because your persona, at least in the punk rock scene, was so very not that.
Art, if you will. That's a little highbrow. But music or some kind of artistic, like non-lethal playground gives you a place to really let it out. I had all that in me. It's just that, where do you put that? If you do it in the schoolyard, you get thrown out or you get arrested. If you do it at your workplace, you get fired. And so you do it in the practice room. And when I saw punk rock bands play, I was like, oh, well, I should be doing that. I mean, that's the place to put a crazy person like me. And many years ago, I was watching a band who I grew up around called the Bad Brains, famous band.
Yeah. Yeah.
And HR, the singer, came up to me and he said, you know, "Henry, you're a singer." And I said, no, you're a singer. Actually, you're the singer as far as I'm concerned. Kind of still is. And he said, "Nope, you're a singer, and tonight you're singing with the Bad Brains." And he literally that night grabbed me out of the audience, put me up on stage, handed me the mic, hopped off the stage, stood in front of the stage with his arms crossed, scowling at me like, "Go, sing." And I kind of knew some of their songs. I saw them all the time. And so we sang a couple of songs. And, you know, I don't know, I forget what people did. I was like 19 or something. And 18, I forget. Anyway, he took the mic back and said, "See, you're a singer." And that was a hell of an endorsement. And so that's kind of how I got into all of that. I can be on stage and kind of be anything I want, and I can kind of sort of do that in acting. But if you say, come to my birthday party, I will absolutely freeze with trepidation.
So a lot of the things, themes, social issues that punk was sort of fighting against or singing about are still present with us today. I read an op-ed that you wrote about President Trump not very long ago, and I wonder if you think there is just always going to be this battle between authoritarianism and liberty or tyranny, I guess, and governmental forces, or is there something different that's changed in the past year or so?
I think you'll always have struggle between those in power and those who see themselves as not or powerless, just because the human brain is so high functioning. Unless you are kind of morally intense, some people will fall prey to, well, why can't I have twice this? And he's not defending his all that much. I'm gonna go take his. And that's how wars start. Well, we're gonna move the border over a few hundred miles. Hey, that's our land. Well, it was. You got something to say about it? And that's, you might think, well, that's people acting primal. No, that's the human brain in fifth gear, actually. You know, we just want more because we're high function. We get bored easily. And that's why more drugs, more this, more that, crazier video games, because we acclimate very quickly. And so you almost have to put a stick in the spokes of your bike, to be fair. And I'm not saying we're all looking to take someone else's stuff. I'm just saying it's kind of amazing that America hasn't ripped itself to pieces a few more times since 1865 cooled off, because people just want what they want, and they don't always are able to employ the brakes and go, whoa, that's not cool. And so you're always going to have misogyny, a certain degree of it. I've seen homophobia, racism, and misogyny in the almost 100 countries I've been to in my life. I think you might have less of it as maybe America embraces science more. And whenever I meet a young woman, a girl, you know, like some 10-year-old girl, a friend of somebody I know, or a daughter, I always say, you know, just know this as a young girl, a young woman, this century is the century of women, and I hope you're a part of that, because this is it. This is where I want to see women change the game. I would love to see women flip the script. And we've tried it. We're men running it for the last, since we crawled out of caves. Let's try something else, and let's give that a few thousand years and see how we go. I'm in. And so I think you might see things getting better with the more women can wrest power away from men. And I think in the last several months, I'm just optimistic, but I think I'm starting to see the beginning of that. And so that's where my optimism lies, where maybe in 2030 something, we're looking at any politician who has, you know, any idea of homophobia or racism or some religious zealotry that's kind of terrifying. We just go, nope, like you're not getting out of the gate, because we're just not there anymore. And punk rock, as an old man looking back at it, I guess what we were doing in a way was folk music. Because if you look at the lyrics of Black Flag and a lot of stuff I did, it's civil rights what we were angry about, you know, and that was the beefs that we were all engaged in when I was in Washington, D.C. as a young punk rock guy. We, all of our friends were gay and weird and anarchists and black and white, and we didn't really have those hang-ups like, well, there's a bass player in that band who's a girl. We're like, well, that's just the bass player. Like, we weren't exactly all PC and ready to, but we were not hung up like that. And it was kind of idyllic for a little while. And maybe that's where we can go. I think what a lot of Americans are seeing now is how bad it can get. There's some Americans who might even miss George W. Bush, who could finish a sentence a lot better than some precedence. And so while it's easy to get down in the mouth, I think when you struggle for what's good, I think we stand a chance.
Henry Rollins, once frontman for the punk band Black Flag, he now enjoys a prolific career hosting radio, doing comedy, doing performances, appearing on TV and movies. He'll be at the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta this Sunday at 8 p.m. It is such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Coming up, ever heard of Bitcoin? The digital currency is making headlines, but that doesn't necessarily mean you should rush out to buy some. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the repeal of net neutrality. Many healthcare services in Georgia rely on the internet to operate. We'll look at the consequences that repeal may have, and we want your thoughts on this. Do you really understand what net neutrality is and what it means to lose it? Call us at 404-500-9457, and be sure to join us tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. for that conversation. Next time you go to the ATM, you might choose to withdraw Bitcoin instead of dollars. A Texas-based Bitcoin network, CoinSource, has installed 18 new ATM machines in Atlanta. Now, if you wonder just what the heck Bitcoin is, you're not alone. A lot of people talk about Bitcoin. Very few people really understand it. And that means it's time to break it down. Ooh, break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again. Break it down now. Bitcoin is a virtual currency. That means there is no tangible evidence of this money. There's no check, no cash card. It's just a number in an online account. Bitcoin is one example of something called cryptocurrency. Bitcoin is not controlled by any nations, like the U.S. dollar is or the euro. And that means it's not manipulated in the way that the Chinese yen is, nor does it rely on the fortunes of banks that are either too big to fail or too small to survive.
A digital currency in which transactions can be performed without the need for a central bank. Woody,
what is a Bitcoin?
Yes.
Who invented this currency? Well, that is the 64,000 Bitcoin question. Back in 2008, a paper was published on the cryptography mailing list. It described a new digital currency, and the author was listed as Satoshi Nakamoto. Satoshi Nakamoto is not the name of a real person. And so far, the world has been unable to figure out who the author really is. If you go to Google Images and search for Satoshi Nakamoto, the picture that you see of a 64-year-old Japanese-American is not Satoshi Nakamoto. There have been any number of theories about Nakamoto's identity, and in 2015, an Australian claimed he was the inventor of Bitcoin. His claim was debunked.
I don't know how to tell you this, so I'm just gonna say it. I'm the one who pretended to be him.
You wouldn't do that.
I did. I really wish I hadn't, but I did.
If you have an extra hour or two, you can entertain yourself by reading about the search for the real inventor of Bitcoin. Whoever he or she is, they're probably rich. Expert analysis shows Nakamoto probably has about $1 billion worth of Bitcoin piled up by this point. But we will leave the detective work to others and continue with our explanation of what Bitcoin is. So, just a few months after that initial paper was published, the so-called Satoshi Nakamoto released software. It was used to create a network, and the first Bitcoins were issued. That software was open source. That means anyone can look through it, and there are no secrets in the code. Bitcoin is transferred digitally. It's transferred instantly. And the transfer usually costs nothing or next to nothing. It's also kind of anonymous. That's why governments are wary of Bitcoin. Lawmakers worry terrorists can use the Bitcoin network to send untraceable amounts of money.
There's these sites where you can sell everything from fake credit cards to illegal guns and drugs, and they use Bitcoin so they can't be traced.
But Bitcoin is not really anonymous. Law enforcement can generally follow the trail of transactions back to a real person because all Bitcoin transfers are public. completely public. Any person with a computer can look at any Bitcoin transaction ever transacted. It's all recorded in a huge digital ledger called the blockchain. Now, blockchain is another term you may not recognize. The blockchain is the data structure that underlies Bitcoin, and it makes Bitcoin possible. But blockchain can be used for so much more than currency. Blockchain is an incredibly powerful technology that could radically change the way we all do business. It could change the way artists and musicians are paid. It could revolutionize the buying of homes and the execution of contracts.
Yeah, I could do that. It should take about 2 minutes. Just PayPal me some bitcoins when you get a chance.
What?
The possibilities of blockchain are mind-boggling, but maybe we should leave that for another time. For now, let's get back to the cryptocurrency that uses blockchain, called Bitcoin. Bitcoin is non-refundable. In other words, once it's been transferred, there is no way to get it back. Not if the bike you ordered never arrives, not if somebody stole your identity and took your Bitcoin. The only way to get it back is if the person who received it chooses to return it.
Yeah, I need to return this book.
I'm sorry, we can't take this book back.
Well, you just lost a lot of business.
And that brings us to the most complicated part of Bitcoin, how you get it. There are three ways to acquire Bitcoin. You can buy it. You can also take Bitcoin as payment for a service or for something that you've sold. The last way is called mining. And I don't mean going into a cave and using a pickaxe like the dwarves in Snow White. In this case, you use a computer to mine for Bitcoin on the internet. But what you're really doing is verifying transactions. Now, let me explain. Let's say I sold you my old iPhone 6 for $50 and you pay in Bitcoin. That transaction is not verified. We don't know that you have actual Bitcoin to use for payment. So the transaction is locked away inside the blockchain. Meanwhile, other people start trying to verify that transaction. That requires special software, a great connection, and patience. According to blockchain.info, it takes more than 200 billion attempts before a miner finds the correct key for verification. And as time goes on, it gets harder and harder to find them. That's because only 21 million bitcoins will ever exist. Remember our elusive friend Satoshi Nakamoto? He or she set a limit on the number of bitcoins that can be circulated. There are currently nearly 16 million out there, so there are only 5 million left to find. And a new one is found about every 9.5 minutes. So if you want to get into the Bitcoin mining game, you're a little late. But you're not too late to use Bitcoin by buying some the traditional way, and then using it to pay for tuition, say, or whatever else your Bitcoin will buy. That's the basics of Bitcoin, but we do have an expert here to explain further. Tom Smith is an economist with Emory University. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Happy New Year. So we have been reading a lot of headlines about this bubble of Bitcoin recently. Does this mean it's time for the average person to start paying attention to Bitcoin?
Well, I think the average person is paying attention to Bitcoin, which is why we're experiencing these huge spikes in prices. So
you mean average people are actually purchasing bits of Bitcoin? Because one Bitcoin is quite expensive. But normal people, I mean regular average, not wealthy people are buying Bitcoin?
Yeah, well, so one Bitcoin is probably trading about $13,000, $14,000. A couple of weeks ago, it was trading at about $20,000.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the beginning of the year, it was trading at, you know, $1,000 or something like that.
At the beginning of 2017.
Oh, excuse me. That's right. It's January 2nd.
Yeah, that's right.
My apologies. So, yeah, So one Bitcoin is, $14,000, right? But when I say the average person is paying attention to it, I mean that people who were at holiday parties at my house were saying, "Hey, what do you know about this? Is this something I should be paying attention to? How do I buy this thing? You know, what does this mean?" And so when I start hearing, my neighbors asking questions about what is this, currency that tells me that people are starting to pay attention to it. Not that they're purchasing it yet, but they're
right.
definitely thinking about something about it.
And as I mentioned, there's a more than a dozen Bitcoin ATM machines going up around Atlanta and in other cities around the country, meaning that I can go there with my debit card and pull out a Bitcoin? I get
sort
a piece
of
paper?
Yeah, well, you get a QVC code essentially that allows you to take a Bitcoin or a portion of a Bitcoin and put it into your digital wallet. And that's where you keep your Bitcoin.
The one of the fears about Bitcoin is what we just recently saw, this massive drop, raise in the price, and then a massive drop in the price, going from, you know, $20,000 to $21,000 per Bitcoin down to $13,000 or $14,000. You certainly don't see that with any other current, like a tangible currency. And how much is Bitcoin variable? Will it always be this volatile?
Well, I mean, right now it's being treated like a commodity, right? And you can
like wheat or corn, cotton.
That's true, and so it just entered onto the futures exchange, and so it is like wheat and like cotton, and it's the value that people put on it is very speculative at this point, just like wheat or cotton or platinum or, you know, other types of commodities. And so, you know, this is all driven by supply and demand. And so if there's this huge demand, people say, I need to purchase this thing, then that's going to drive up the price. If you see something like South Korea is engaging in a political action that says we're trying to eliminate any kind of anonymous accounts, right? And so what that's going to do is that's going to sort of decrease the demand for Bitcoin across the globe, which will then change the price again, probably pushing it down.
So if I am a small business owner and someone wants to pay me in Bitcoin, is that a risky transaction?
Probably. I mean, it sort of depends on what your perspective
is. That'd be like someone saying, I'll pay you in stock.
Well, it's even weirder than that. It's like somebody saying, you know, I'll pay you in, I've got 20 old boxes of Air Jordans from 1987. And so I want to pay you, I'm going to give you 17, you know, size 11 Air Jordans for a car. I mean, that's risky because you'd have to look at what is the value that Air Jordans are currently trading for. This is what I'm going to sell my car for. And then you have to transact it. And the way that you're transacting, you know, Air Jordans to a car or Bitcoin to a car is through dollars. Like, you have to convert your commodity, your Bitcoin, to this good or service. And you're doing it through these exchanges. You know, once upon a time, people didn't really know the value of these things. And so they took a chance and they said, okay, I'll give you a pizza for 19 Bitcoin or whatever it happened to be, you know.
That was before it was worth $14,000 each, which would make it the most expensive pizza ever.
I think they did. I mean, I read an article about that, and that pizza's worth, you know, like whatever, $1 billion.
Because for a while, Georgia Tech was taking Bitcoin for tuition, and they stopped doing that. And I have to assume, because of the volatility of Bitcoin, we're not quite at the place where Emory, your institution, could accept Bitcoin for payment.
Yeah, I don't think Emory takes Bitcoin for payment.
Not,
yeah, I don't think they take Air Jordans either, right? And so they like the hard cash.
It would be very cool if they did.
I'm kind of surprised that Georgia Tech isn't continuing it, just because it is so, well, that's a really cool idea to, you know, pay your tuition in Bitcoin. But I think people are willing to take chances. And so, you know, I was thinking about it the other day, and so I was like, every once in a while I go out and give talks, and I'm like, yeah, I should really say, oh, I'll give a talk for, you know, a tenth of a Bitcoin, right? And this is the other thing you didn't mention in the prequel, which I thought was really well done.
Thanks.
Was that you don't have to buy, like, a single Bitcoin. And when you mine Bitcoins, you don't get a Bitcoin.
Right.
You get fractions, right? And so it's like, you know, one with six zeros in front of it, in a decimal point.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like you're getting one, you know, hundredth, thousandth of a Bitcoin, and that's okay because it still has value. At $14,000, you can get, you know, you can get $140 worth of Bitcoin. It looks like 0.00, you know, 1125 or something like this, but you can get that. you can trade that.
So, I mean, Bitcoin has been available for a number of years, and for a very long time, the sort of established banks and established experts on Wall Street have told us, don't worry about that. That's, you know, that's not credible. It's not going to be it's not going to last. What do you feel about sort of the future of Bitcoin and whether this is going to be an actual viable currency?
Well, in order for something to be a currency, it has to be a widely accepted medium of exchange.
Right.
And so it sort of, there's no definition of what widely accepted is. And I think Bitcoin, and there's a bunch, Litecoin, Ethereum, I mean, there's a bunch of them out there right now. These are becoming more acceptable. And as they become more acceptable, they go from being quirky to being much like a currency, or more like a currency.
Is it all that different than gold, which is another commodity and whose price changes?
Only in so much that people readily accept gold as, you know, as having some kind of an established value,
yeah.
Right? But I mean, think about this. Like in Dubai, you can go to a gold ATM and get yourself, you know, like
a gold bar comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you should YouTube it. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever be able to go to an ATM and withdraw a gold bar. I don't see my finances being in that location.
Well, but the gold bar that you can buy is like maybe $250 or $300 worth of gold. So you just put it in there and you get yourself a very small little gold piece of gold foil. It comes in a really nice looking box. But I mean, you can get $250 or $500 worth of gold, and that's very similar to what this ATM, you know, the Bitcoin ATM is supposed to be. Is you're not going to throw in $13,000 and get yourself a Bitcoin. The idea is you could put in a couple $200-$300 and get part of a Bitcoin.
Do you own Bitcoin?
I don't.
Will you?
Probably.
You will probably buy at least a fraction of a Bitcoin.
Absolutely. Well, I'm hoping to transact something so that somebody will pay me in Bitcoin.
Oh, there you go.
But I mean that's risky, right? So
it
I mean,
is.
You know, so I mean if I do some research for somebody and I say, you know, instead of giving me $10,000, give me 0.0, you know, 1
8,
Bitcoin,
5, yeah,
whatever
exactly.
It happens to be, right? And so I mean that's risky, but I think that in this state, you have to take some of these risks sometimes, and I think that's what I want to do. So,
all right, that is Tom Smith. He's an economist and assistant professor of finance at Emory University, willing to take the risk this year.
That's right. I'm ready and willing.
All right,
and able.
So there you heard his offer. If you need him to do research or give a speech for you, you can pay him in a fraction of a Bitcoin. That is our show.
I'll be waiting by the phone.
Be waiting by your computer. Come on, you can't use that old
That's
analog
right.
technology.
That's right.
If you would invest in Bitcoin, we definitely want to hear about that. But we talked earlier with Henry Rollins, formerly of the band Black Flag, and we wonder, what were you listening to in the 80s? Or what are you listening to now that was recorded in the 80s? What music stands the test of time from that decade? You can let us know at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.